This is Broadway to Brazil, the only podcast to tell the remarkable story of Corinthians Casuals FC, the English non-league club who are big in Brazil. Hello, listener. Welcome back to Broadway to Brazil. In our opening episode, we introduced you to Corinthians Casuals, this little-known English football club worshipped by thousands in Sao Paulo, Brazil. We discovered that the Casuals hold a level of fame on the other side of the Atlantic to such an extent that many of these Brazilians make the pilgrimage to their tiny ground in Tolworth, southwest London. And yet, despite all of this, many locals in the area are pretty unfamiliar with their existence. Yet a couple of hundred hardcore fans turn up for almost every home game, and right now they're being richly rewarded. The club continues to overperform, considering it has no playing budget. Having narrowly missed out on promotion last season, they are once again in the mix at the top of the table as we enter the festive period in the 2017-18 campaign. And this in a league where pretty much everyone else has a bit of cash to spend on player salaries. In November, they even rose to the top of the Bostic South League, and they remain in the promotion picture as we approach the new year. But why don't they pay their players when everyone else does? How does it affect their performances on the field? How are they able to compete today or historically at a time when all of their rivals were supposedly amateur as well, but in reality illicitly paying their players? To understand all of this further, we spoke to some of the people who know best, including former players such as Sky Sports commentator Martin Tyler, and former England cricketer Mickey Stewart.
It was the era of the shamateurism where you could earn money by going to clubs when they weren't supposed to pay you. And
it was called senior amateur football, which was hypocritical because the majority of them got backhanders and brown envelopes.
I've had offers consistently over those 7 years to leave and pick up 100 quid here and there. Here you turn up, the pitch is perfect, the people get behind you, there's never a single moan in the stand about the stand of football or what you're doing, or it's always positive.
The players here categorically do not and never have got a penny.
But first, we need to delve deeper into the history, starting with the founding of the original Corinthians FC in 1882. English football was a very different game in the Victorian era. 1882 is 6 years before there was even a league system to speak of, and only 10 years after the first ever codified international took place between England and Scotland, sparking the world's oldest football rivalry, one that continues to this day. In fact, England's poor early performances in this fixture lie at the very root of Corinthians football history.
In the early days, basically, the England players would line up 8-1-1 and basically run in a straight line till they lost the ball. Where Scotland actually just passed it around them, I think, in the early days.
That's Rob Cavallini, a man who can stake a pretty strong claim to being the Corinthians Casuals' foremost historian, having written books on the history of Corinthians FC, the history of Casuals FC, and of course the history of post-merger Corinthians Casuals FC. Rob told us about one man in particular who was so frustrated by England's unsophisticated approach that he decided to do something about it. He was a football administrator called Nicholas Lane Jackson, or Pa, as the players knew him, because he was like a father figure to them. Pa Jackson yearned for England to emulate the Scotland players' familiarity with one another and the cohesive teamwork he believed had been at the heart of their success over England on six separate occasions leading up to 82. He felt that the best way for the English players to develop that kind of understanding would be by playing regularly for the same club side. And so, in a small upstairs room of the London Football Association HQ, Jackson and all the best players in his contact book met under a single gaslight and agreed to form the Corinthians Football Club. Today, if you ask Google to define Corinthian for you, it will tell you that it is either an inhabitant of the ancient city of Corinth, or an adjective that means involving the highest standards of amateur sportsmanship. But that latter definition is the effect, rather than the cause, of the naming of Pa Jackson's enterprise. Back in the 1880s, you'd more likely hear it described as a gentleman of fashion and pleasure. In other words, the type of gentlemen who had enough money and social standing to devote a lot of their time to kicking a ball around without being paid for it, as Rob explains.
They were amateur from the start. There was no ambition to become professional players because most of the players would never have needed to earn money in that way. And it was part of the British ethos of amateurism, which sort of manifested itself throughout the Olympic movement and what have you.
But before learning more about this amateur underpinning to the Corinthian ethos that continues to prevail today, we first needed to find out from Rob whether it worked. Did the founding of Corinthian FC actually improve the fortunes of the England national side?
The Corinthians adopted this passing system, mastered it, and then England, once they moved on to the next level, were able to start beating Scotland on a regular basis. And a lot of it was down to the Corinthians bringing this to the fore because they were the first club to do so. And they were regularly fielding five or six players in the England side, and it had a definite impact. Before the club was founded, Scotland had been basically winning every single game, and up to 1887, the complete record read Scotland 10 wins, England 2, and drawn games 4. When you take it a bit further on, once the club was established, from 1888 to 1895, Scotland only won one game. Two games were drawn, and England won every other fixture.
Over 100 England caps were awarded to Corinthian players in the 18-year period between their founding and the turn of the century. In today's money, that might not be as impressive, but bear in mind that back then there were at most only 3 international matches each year. Most tellingly, in England's 1894 and 1895 fixtures against Wales, the entire starting 11 was made up of Corinthians players. It was England by name, Corinthian by nature. They remain the only club in English football history with such a claim.
The Corinthians were the backbone of the side for quite a few years in this period. No other amateur club by that stage was really contributing many players. So it was the Corinthians leading the amateur world.
But the game rapidly developed beyond amateurism. The Football League was founded in 1888, 3 years after professionalism was legalised by the FA. Until this point, clubs had illegally circumvented FA rules in order to pay their players under the table, a concept that would later become known as shamateurism. The Corinthians, however, had no desire to join this league system, nor the already established FA Cup. They may have made the England side more competitive, but the club had no interest in competitive football. Here's Rob Cavallini again.
It was partly through their wish to remain amateur and keep the traditions of that game because they felt that competitive football would maybe not to their taste. It could be too competitive when you're dealing with relegation and trying to win cups. But the other fact is that the players, they shared their players with other clubs. I mean, on a Saturday, they could be playing for Old Carthusians or Old Etonians, who were a good standard at that point in time. And on a Wednesday, they play for the Corinthians. So they wouldn't have been able to field their strong team, and they'd have to ask their players to decide between clubs. They really just wanted to develop the game, I think, rather than get involved with the riffraff.
And so the Corinthians continued as they had been doing, improving the nationwide standard of football while restricting their matchday appearances to exhibition games only. Although it should be noted at this stage that friendlies at that time were much more fiercely contested than they are today. But the main point that should be missed is the fact that this Corinthians team were, well, pretty damn good. Just ask Manchester United if you can find one of their supporters from 1904. Their 11-3 crushing at the hands of the Corinthians in that year represents their largest ever defeat on record, even if, as an exhibition game, you might not find it in your Wikipedia pages and official club records. You could almost think of them as the Harlem Globetrotters of their time. In England, they may not have entered the FA Cup, but they did regularly take part in an annual showpiece fixture against its holders in the Sheriff of London Shield, the precursor to today's Community Shield. In the same year of the Man United beating, 1904, they also dished out a 10-3 thrashing to Bury, who themselves had just recently won the FA Cup final by a record margin of 6-0. while, as we will learn in later episodes, the club also took the game to several countries around the world and routinely dished out thrashings over there as well. All of this while remaining loyal to their ethos of gentlemanly sportsmanship, which won them friends wherever they went, as well as earning themselves quite the sporting reputation.
They were in great demand. They went all around the country playing the top professional teams. And the professional clubs wanted to play them because, one, it was a good standard of opposition. And Corinthians won probably 50% of the games against the professional clubs. The other factors was it was going to be a good attendance. The Corinthians actually got bigger attendances outside London and not when they were on their travels in the north of England.
Fast forward several decades. It's April 1956, and 17 years since Corinthian FC merged with Casuals FC to form the Corinthian Casuals, and the club are about to appear in the FA Amateur Cup final at the home of English football, Wembley Stadium. Broadway to Brazil's Dominic Bliss has been chatting to a member of that 56 squad, finding out more about being a truly amateur club in a shamateur era.
Competitive football may not have been part of the Corinthian spirit, but the club they merged with, Casuals FC, while sharing the amateur way of life, and indeed a number of the same players as the Corinthians, did not share their hang-ups about entering competitive league and cup-based football. In fact, Casuals were winners of the Amateur Cup as recently as 1936. And so, after the merger, which came about largely as a result of both clubs struggling for players and finances, a club carrying the Corinthian name entered into the English Football League system for the first time. Assuming the old Casuals commitments in the Surrey Senior Cup and the Isthmian League, the first league set up exclusively for amateur clubs in the South East, of which Casuals FC were a founder member. One member of the 56 squad who helped propel Corinthian Casuals to this Wembley final was Mickey Stewart, now president of the club, but perhaps better known for his career as an opening batsman and then coach of the England cricket team. His son Alex Stewart, meanwhile, went on to captain England and is the country's second most capped test cricketer of all time. But at King George's Field, he's just as revered for all those times he's played centre-back for Corinthian Casuals, at several different levels over the years. We'll be hearing from both father and son over the course of this series, but first let's go back to Mickey's playing days, which were something of a second golden age for the club.
Well, it goes back 60 odd years as when playing. I only played 1 year for them, or for us I should say, which is 55-56, which is a memorable year because the club got to the Amateur Cup final at Wembley, where 87,000 people turned up.
Back in the mid-50s, Mickey played centre midfield for Corinthian Casuals, but despite playing all the way to the semi-final of that Amateur Cup run in 56, he was unable to join his teammates at Wembley. He had a good excuse, though. He was in the Caribbean for an England international cricket tour. However, when the match at Wembley ended in a draw, a replay was scheduled to take place just as Mickey's cricket tour was wrapping up. Having received a telegram with details of the replay, which was to take place at Middlesbrough's Ayresome Park, Mickey set forth on a race against time from Trinidad to the northeast of England in the hope of arriving at the ground before the team sheet had been handed into the referee without his name on it. I caught up with Mickey to hear this extraordinary story firsthand.
Well, we were due to, left Trinidad, then go to Caracas, where we were going to. In those days, you had to wind the elastic or refuel or whatever it was. Everybody, there was a delay coming off the plane, and suddenly we came down the plane to come off, and there were about a dozen gentlemen with Sten guns and the lot pointing them up. And that was, I don't know exactly what the form was, but that was the first delay. And then on the way over from the States, there was fog at Gander because you had to literally refuel in those days in Newfoundland. So that was another big delay. And I'd given up the thought of playing. The plane was directed up to Edinburgh, to Scotland. I thought, and I came off and I looked down again. There were photographers at the bottom of the stairs. And I thought, I've been on this plane all this time. There must have been film stars on it or something like that, but as it turned out, it had made headlines in the paper as to whether I was going to get there in time or not. And there was the only equivalent biplane on the runway to fly me to the military airport nearest to Middlesbrough.
Wow.
As I got out in a police car, I'd shoved in a police car, taken there. I put my foot on the ground. As I'd opened the door, the referee blew his whistle to start the game.
At this point, it's important to point out that substitutes were not allowed in football at this time. Mickey was condemned to be a spectator.
So what was your overriding feeling? One of disappointment or one that you're glad you made kick-off?
Yeah, I'd accepted that I wasn't going to be sometime, obviously disappointed, yeah. But the guy who had taken my place halfway through the first half smashed one in from outside the box, so we went one up.
Unfortunately, the Corinthian Casuals did not hold on to the lead and ultimately went down 4-1 to their opponents, Bishop Auckland. But despite the loss and the disappointing end to Mickey's mad dash across the Atlantic, that run to the 56 Amateur Cup final is seen as one of the most impressive achievements in the club's post-merger history, which, in contrast to that of the old Corinthian FC, has often been defined by struggle. Struggles to find a home, struggles to attract players willing to play for free, struggles to stay in the Isthmian League, struggles even to stay afloat. In the modern era, Corinthian Casuals' on-field struggles have largely been a result of their voluntary decision to stay amateur, while all those around them have formally turned semi-professional, which basically means paying the players something, if not enough to call it a living. But up until 1974, the disadvantage that the Casuals faced relative to their peers was not one of their choosing. At that stage, everybody else at their level was also supposed to be entirely amateur, with payment to players outside of the professional leagues entirely illegal. But as Mickey Stewart testifies, shamateurism, the secret payment of amateur players emulating the practice of the leading clubs of the 1880s, was not only widespread, but so lucrative for those involved that they were actually often better paid than professional players who were subject to a wage cap.
It was called senior amateur football, which was hypocritical because the majority of them got backhanders and brown envelopes,
yeah.
But never at a club such as Corinthian Casuals, which was strictly amateur. But it was ridiculous. Wouldn't you say it was amateur football? And you were far better off playing amateur football than you were playing what is today called Premiership football, money-wise.
Really? Because of the shamateurism.
Well, the 3 years that I went pro, there was maximum wage, a bit, right?
Mm-hmm. Before Johnny Haynes and his crew got
Well, he was the first £100 that they made publicity out of that.
Mm.
But the maximum wage was £15 a week and £1 a point. Second year was £17 a week and £1 a point. And the last year was £20 a week and £2 a point. So it was absolutely ridiculous.
Rob Cavallini elaborates further on what shamateurism meant in the context of Corinthian Casual principles.
It may be a case that players realised that they could earn more having a full-time job and playing for some of the leading amateur clubs. I mean, and there was different things in place. I know one amateur player who played for a South London club, and he said, basically, I could go into any restaurant in that particular town and not pay the bill because the club would pick it up. And he said I had a great time because I was out every night. So there was different ways clubs did it. I met Terry Huddle, who was the goalkeeper for the 1936 Amateur Cup final win for the Casuals. And it was an amateur's privilege to guest for other clubs. And he went over one Tuesday night at the end of the season. I think Bromley was short of a couple of players. And he helped them out. He played the game. He came into the dressing room afterwards and he found a little brown envelope in his shoe with a couple of pounds in it. And he was like, what is this? That's your appearance fee. This is like mid to late 30s. And he said, I'm never going to play for you again because he was totally against his ethos.
At this stage, it's time to introduce another former Casual who you may also be familiar with for his work elsewhere. Martin Tyler has been the voice of Sky Sports Premier League football coverage since the early 90s, but what you probably don't know is that Tyler himself can directly draw a link between his hugely successful broadcasting career and his Corinthian Casuals playing days, which began in 1968. As he told us, the practice of secretly paying amateur footballers was rife among the club's Isthmian League rivals.
And we had some good players, but the ones that did well immediately got hooked by other teams because it was the era of the shamateurism where you could earn money by going to clubs when they weren't supposed to pay you. And actually, I had one chance to do that. It was the opening weekend of one season in the early 70s. I played for our reserves at Wealdstone's ground, very nice ground, the old ground that Wealdstone had, Lower Mead, I think it was called. I scored two and we won. And on the Sunday morning, I was still living at home. My dad had a shop in West Byfleet, and the phone rang at home on the Sunday, and that, my mum picked it up and said, "Oh, it's for you." And it was the secretary of Wealdstone, not the manager, that was, which bothered me, saying, "Oh, you did very well yesterday. Would you like to come and play for us?" They made me an offer, a shamateur offer. I think it was something like £10 a game or something, but only if I was in the first team. And I probably didn't believe in myself enough, having shuttled up and down from the first team to the reserves with printing casuals, where you did get expenses in the reserves. So I said no, and I often wonder. I have met the manager who offered me those terms, a guy called Alan Humphreys, a few times in the last 10 or 15 years. And I always say to him, if I'd accepted your offer, I don't think I would have had my broadcasting career, because I would have played in a better level of football. Maybe I would have done okay, maybe I wouldn't, but we'll never know.
And echoing the words of Mickey Stewart, this wasn't small money flying around.
The way the shamateurism worked really was that the money wasn't always consistently at the same clubs, and people moved clubs. So you knew where the money was. The top England amateur internationals moved clubs, and therefore you knew. I played against Wickham, and a centre-half who was an England amateur international, who then finally, at the age of 32, I think, turned professional, called John Delaney. And when we played Wickham, I didn't get much of the ball. They were a very good side. So I asked him what he was on, and he said he was on £75 a week, and that was 1971, two, something like that.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. That was a lot of money. So I don't think we're letting out any secrets now. That's all an era gone, and it's why. And everybody knew it because they changed. As soon as I finished, actually, it became all the same.
As Tyler was making moves in the commentating world and reaching the end of his playing career, the FA got wise to the practice and finally ended this sham. In 1974, the distinction between amateur and professional players, teams and competitions was abolished once and for all.
You know, everybody could pay, including Corinthian casuals. It's up to that point, they were adhering to the rules and the Corinthian spirit and all that stuff, and doing it absolutely by the book. After that, it's been a choice.
Mm.
The choice has been not to pay.
And that remains their choice today, despite the fact that the other clubs in what is now known as the Bostic South Division pay their players, the only exception being Channel Islanders Guernsey FC, whose players play for the honour of representing their island. This has, predictably enough, meant that the casuals have often found it tough to compete, as Brian Vandervelt, chairman for the last 15 years, explains.
We've always been the proverbial strugglers, because being the highest placed purely amateur side in the country, it's always been a struggle. We've always, even in staying in the league that we're in, staying there really means we're punching above our weight very considerably. So we've always had a struggle. For the 12 seasons, I would say, we've just about avoided relegation, and that's been a pretty fantastic achievement.
It's when viewed through this context that manager James Bracken's recent promotion-chasing exploits over the last three seasons begin to look seriously impressive, as Alec, the younger of the club's cricketing stewards, testifies.
Look, there's plenty of clubs around the country, around the world, that are full of volunteers. But this one, is because it's a true amateur club in a semi-professional business, that's what makes it unique. And the fact that it's competitive. You know, they don't just turn up, make the numbers up, get beat and go home. You know, lost in the playoff final last year. They're currently sat third this year. But they're about winning. They're trying to win in the right way. There's still that Corinthian spirit. In this day and age, it's very difficult to maintain that. But, as I say, the culture it's instilled into the players and into the club is very much that.
As we detailed in our previous episode, the great irony of Bracken's extraordinary recent success is that some of his peers in the league have started to turn the tables on him and accuse the club of being shamateurs themselves. It's an accusation that Chairman Vandervelt gave short shrift when we put it to him.
We spoke to James in pre-season, and he said because of how well
the team had performed over the last couple of years, there were some people who accused the Corinthian Casuals of secretly paying their players, i.e. being sort of shamateurs of the olden era. I mean, what would your response to such accusations be?
Certainly at the moment, because of our great success, nobody genuinely believes we don't pay boot money or expenses. The players here categorically do not and never have got a penny. They come to training at their own expense. They come to all the matches at their own expense. They do not receive any benefits from this club whatsoever, other than us providing for them, and this is our biggest expense, coaches to away matches. We pay for those. It's a big drain on us. We actually exist on an overdraft, and there's no money going to anybody within this club other than the physio, who should obviously be paid. The manager doesn't get a penny, doesn't get any expenses, he doesn't get any contributions to telephone, travelling. He does it totally free. It costs him, and indeed every player that we've got here, money to play for this great club.
It's not just that they're not receiving money, they're having to spend money themselves.
Of course, yeah. They've got to get here. They've got to travel to away games if they're fairly close. No, it's a great cost to them, and they're losing. Every one of the players we have at the moment is capable of playing semi-professionally and would be receiving money. So it's a wonderful achievement that we've got them here. And our greatest problem all the time is that there is this possible payment to them that they can obtain, and off they go to another club. They stay with us a season or so, and then understandably go off to earn a few pennies to pay for their car or their mortgage or their whatever, their life.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, being a player for the Corinthian Casuals doesn't just mean no wage. It's actually to your financial detriment to play for them. This naturally raises the question, why do it? Well, who better to provide an insight than one of the club's most long-standing players? Danny Bracken has the unique distinction of being club captain, goalkeeper, and the manager's brother. After a match this season, he spoke with our reporter Tony Banks and provided an insight into why he and some other long-serving players stick around.
So have you had offers? You could have gone and left and played at a higher level, yeah?
Yeah, I've been here 7 years. I've had offers consistently over those 7 years to leave and pick up 100 quid here and there. It's £100. It's £100.
Yeah.
Here you turn up, the pitch is perfect, the people get behind you. There's never a single moan in the stand about the standard of football or what you're doing. It's always positive.
Yeah.
And you won't get that many clubs.
Yeah.
Most supporters go to have a moan at the team.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's most non-league clubs.
Yeah.
Because we're paying them 50 quid, we can have a go at them and we can abuse them. But here, no, everyone's supportive. Everyone wants the same thing.
What do you do for a living, Danny?
I'm a school teacher.
Right.
So I'm not paid a lot.
So
a few hundred quid in football would improve, but it's £200. I'd rather play here where people appreciate you.
Yeah.
A lot of these non-league players, they have a good four games somewhere and then they go somewhere else. And go, what happened to him?
Yeah.
No one ever knows because they just disappear because they never stick around somewhere.
Well, that's the thing about this club, because yourself, Hodges, there's people that buy it, for instance.
Yeah.
My God, they're almost fixtures here, which is quite unusual in non-league football, isn't it?
Especially when you've got no money.
Yeah.
You get a few people stick around when they're on 300 quid a week and they think it's cushy and loyal.
Yeah.
They're only loyal because the money's there.
Yeah.
If the money got cut, they'd be the first ones out the door.
Yeah.
I'd choose a job that I can do so I can get to every football. I wouldn't work in a job that held me back. I couldn't work in the city because I couldn't work late nights and miss a route Margate away on a Tuesday night. Once I get to that point, then I feel I wouldn't want to play anymore because I want to commit to every week, I want to play every game, and I'll always do a job that can support that.
It's no accident that the squad is formed of players who share this mentality. Chairman Brian Vandervelt once more. Those ones that don't take up that temptation, and there are many who stay at the club despite being offered money elsewhere. I mean, what do you think, what motivates them to stay here at this club despite not being paid a penny?
We're a family. Our manager has them all together. They have a great family attitude. They're great friends of each other. The success helps. If we weren't successful and winning these matches that we're winning and being at the top, I think it might be a very different story. but they feel committed to the club at their own expense, and that's wonderful.
And the sort of the whole devotion to amateurism, it has this historical resonance, obviously. Do you ever just wish that you could just pay your players 50 quid a week or 100 quid a week or whatever? Do you ever wish you could be like your peers in the league? Or
no, never. The ethos of the club, it's installed, it's concrete. It will never be anything other than a strictly amateur side. We would never allow it. We've had people come along that have been seriously interested in buying or owning the club, and we're a members club. Legally, we might change from that in the not too distant future, but we would never allow the ownership of the club to pass outside of the members of the club. No way whatsoever. We could do it, but we won't, and we must guard against ever doing it. And that's our biggest problem with regard to sponsorship and finance.
Why do you think it is important that you never succumb to that?
Because we want to play the game for the love of it, for the sport of it, for the camaraderie. Once you start introducing money, it changes it. And of course, we really are the last club of any consequence that believes in it. And we always believed in it, and that's the foundation of the club from the beginning, and we should never change it.
The Corinthian Casuals. Proud amateurs playing for the love of a game in a world increasingly dominated by professionalism and commerce. But while they may be strictly amateur financially, on a sporting level, manager James Bracken insists on a level of professionalism in approach. In episode one, James discussed just how well-earned this success truly is, considering the players he loses and the resources his rivals have at their disposal. But how does he do it? What's the secret, and why are his unpaid players so devoted to his methods? And what motivates the man? In episode three of Broadway to Brazil, we'll be temporarily putting the brakes on our history tour as we focus on the present day, tapping into the psyche of the man at the helm, James Bracken, manager, leader, and a man desperate to defy the odds and take an entirely unpaid team into the Bostic Premier Division.
And someone turned around at me, because I won 30 trophies in 9 years, and they turned around at me, the exact words were, "Yeah, but it's easy." And I turned around and I said, "Well, if it's so easy, why is everybody not winning quadruples and trebles in the same season?" And they couldn't really answer me.
We'll be hearing from those that have worked with him, players, chairman, and former colleagues who discuss what makes James, James.
He has a wonderful ability to pick the positives out of anything. And they're not foolish positives, they're genuine positives. He's a very fine coach. All of the players here tell us that they've never been coached in the way that he's coaching them. It's very professional.
I respect him as a manager. I respect him. If he was not my brother, the attitude that I'd have in the changing room would be no different. He's the best manager I've ever played for. And there's no doubt about that.
Tune in for our next episode in the new year. Broadway to Brazil is presented and written by me, Yarick Zaba, with Dominic Bliss. Produced and edited by Brent Davies, with Tony Banks, our reporter in the field. Chris Kelly is web manager, and Kelly Bliss is responsible for our artwork. With huge thanks to John Forrest and everyone at Corinthian Casuals Football Club, to the Community Brain for use of the Museum of Futures, and to Robin Hutchinson, the top boy of Torcida Seething. Broadway to Brazil is a Creative Brain Media production. Find us at broadwaytobrazil.com, where you can also find our social media channels. For more Creative Brain output, check out theus100.com.